to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today is the third anniversary of the death of Michael Brown, so of course we will be discussing that issue here today. But before we can move on, earlier in the year, we noted that while immigration arrests were up, deportations themselves were down. And now with more data that runs through June 30th, we can see that this is indeed the trend. Not ironically enough, Trump is on track to deport fewer people this year than even some of the years Obama deported the least people. In Trump's first 100 days, his administration touted that immigration arrests were up 38%. In terms of actual deportation, the Trump administration is removing on average 16,900 people per month. In 2016, ICE was averaging about 20,000 deportations a month. And in 2012, the peak Obama deportation year, ICE was actually removing roughly 34,000 people per month. The discrepancy between the two numbers raises some interesting issues. First, it almost certainly suggests that the Trump tactic of immigration enforcement is not effective. We've pointed out numerous times here that Trump's use of ICE and his bully pulpit on this issue has been as much about perception as anything else. Trump is trying to push undocumented people back into the shadows aggressively. That's why one day he'll be saying how much he loves the people who are covered by DACA and is very moved by their stories. Then the next day, he's trying to deport people who are supposed to be covered by DACA. They're going for a maximum fear factor effect regardless of the impact. ICE is patrolling courtrooms looking for the undocumented. And as we've outlined on this show, some lawyers have even warned people to not come and testify in court cases because if they do, ICE will arrest and then deport them. So for ICE and Trump, who cares if a few rapists go free as long as undocumented people are too scared to show up in public places. ICE has also started trying to be present at schools as well to arrest people, clearly a measure designed to sow fear amongst immigrants by alarming and upsetting thousands of immigrant children, making them fear just being dropped off at school could get their parents kicked out of the country. I say all that to say one reason deportations won't skyrocket exponentially is that Trump almost certainly is arresting a bunch of people who are here legally. From October of 2015 to July of 2016, judges granted only 43% of deportation orders the government sought, down from 70% in 2011. This is partly why courts are increasingly taking up the issue of whether or not immigrant detainees should have the ability to be released pending trial, because thousands upon thousands of people here legally languish in detention centers, sometimes for years, as their cases wind through the courts. The timing of this is worth noting because the surge of immigrants from Central America around the same time prompted a more aggressive immigration crackdown by the Obama administration. Looking at the trends then through 2016, it seems clear that when ICE cracks down, all they know how to do is dragnets, where they arrest large numbers of people in the country legally as well. As it concerns Trump, it's also worth noting that for all his bluster about immigration, he has done absolutely nothing to stop the H-1B visa allegedly for highly skilled workers and the H-2B visa for allegedly so-called unskilled workers. So in other words, while he terrorizes immigrant children in grammar school, Trump hasn't taken one step to cut off the flow of highly exploited low-wage labor to his own buddies or even his own golf club at Mar-a-Lago. Trump doesn't care about immigration per se. He's happy for people to be brought to this country in a way he and his rich buddies can benefit from paying them lower wages. And he's also happy to use immigration as a racist wedge issue to boost his own electoral chances, too. A new report from the Vera Institute for Justice is shining new light on the large amount of children thrown in jail for even being late to class, which sounds crazy, you must be saying. But in Wisconsin, you can be referred to court for being late to class 5 times. So-called crimes like these are known as status offenses. Some, like underage drinking, are well known, but they encompass mainly a significant portion of them, things that very few people would consider either crimes or something you should go to jail for. Yet, in 2014 alone, there were 100,100 children in jail for some sort of status offense. Shockingly, running away from home, it can be considered a status offense as well, and oftentimes is. So many kids are actually locked up for leaving home without guardian permission, which is clearly a serious issue when one considers that at least 40% of homeless youth are LGBTQ and who are often kicked out of their house by their parents or have to run away to maintain their own safety. And obviously, children facing abusive situations are also in a position to be criminalized just for trying to keep themselves safe. Further, a 2010 census found that girls accounted for 16% of all detained youth nationwide, but 40% of detentions for status offenses. It also cost $149,000 to incarcerate a kid for a year, as Vera points out. They also point out this cost doesn't include the indirect long-term price of confining kids, such as recidivism, lost future earnings, and additional Medicaid/Medicare spending, which is estimated to cost the country $8 to $21 billion a year. The upshot there is it's very expensive to incarcerate these young people for things that mostly shouldn't be crimes anyway. So here we are, yet again, with just more examples of how mass incarceration is a true scourge on our nation. Today is the third anniversary of the death of Michael Brown at the hands of police in Ferguson, Missouri. Michael Brown was not the first young black person to die at the hands of the police. In fact, sadly, his case wasn't even particularly exceptional. However, his murder became a turning point in the black liberation movement. For a few days, the people of Ferguson rose up. They refused to allow for peace without the presence of justice. The massive forces of the state, whose militarized police were out in full force, did not. Repeat, did not quell or stop them. This willful act of defiance of the riot cops inspired an explosion across the nation as hundreds of thousands in cities and in towns across the country took to the streets with a new rallying cry, Black Lives Matter. Quite a bit has happened since then, but things are not the same. The temptation on an anniversary like this would be to point out how the basic situation has not changed much at all. The police are on track to kill more people this year than 2015 and 2016. If the current pace continues, roughly 1,200 people will be killed by the cops this year, just over the normal average of 1,000. It also continues to be highly disproportionate, with police using violence against people about 7 times more than it's used against them, and killing people about 9 times more than they are killed. It's also pretty common knowledge if you get caught killing a cop, you're going to jail for life or to the death house. Since 2005, though, roughly 12,000 people have been killed by cops, and in that time, 77 officers were charged with murder or manslaughter. Only 26 were convicted. So 12,000 murders, 26 convictions. A recent study of people who killed police officers in 2013 and 2014 found the 70 individual killers, half were ended up being convicted there. So it's a roughly 50% conviction rate for those who kill cops, as opposed to, on average, a 0.2% conviction rate for cops who kill civilians. We, of course, shouldn't lose sight of this, but also should not simply allow that to be the whole story. While the Obama administration did very little on this issue, close to nothing, they did do one thing of note. They launched Justice Department inquiries into the practices of policing in many major cities that set in stone that what black communities had been saying about abuses by the police was not only true, but massively widespread and clearly results in mass violations of the constitutional rights of millions on a yearly basis. In Chicago and Philadelphia, pro-police murder DAs were thrown out of office, and in New York, a mayor was even elected on opposing police brutality, and in Washington, D.C., several laws have been passed tightening the leash on the cops just a bit, as clearly large majorities of people around the nation are fed up and want to see change. Which brings us to the most important fact, and that's that a new movement has arisen. It's perhaps a bit more diffuse, but there is really a zero doubt that the movement for Black Lives has reinvigorated a radical movement of primarily young people in America that is obviously still deeply affecting politics and thus starting real attempts to contend for power. 3 years later, Mike Brown didn't die in vain. The memory of his life and how he died still animates a movement of millions that in the streets and at the ballot box clearly just isn't going away. And those are today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting a political, social, and economic movement shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are very happy to be joined here for this conversation on the third anniversary of Mike Brown's death. Murder, I should say, by Dr. David Raglan, peace and conflict resolution scholar and part of the Truth Telling Project in Ferguson. Christine Hendricks, who's a Ferguson frontline activist, mother of three, and secretary to the University City School Board. And Sean Blackman from the Stop Police Terror Project DC. Thank you all for joining the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for having me.
So, Dr. Raglan, I'll start with you here. Here we are, third anniversary of Michael Brown's death. And the sort of lead-in to the show, I was saying a little bit about how obviously, you know, the issue of police murder is not gone, but I'm hesitant to say that Michael Brown died in vain because I do think that the movement that arose after the uprising in Ferguson in response to his death is still pushing forward and still making gains, even if it's in different ways. But your thoughts here on this third anniversary?
I mean, I think that you're right. In part, there's a it seems to be, even if it's not in Ferguson, there continues to be police violence. But at the same time, the movement that arose, I think, sparked something huge around the country. Number one, the throwing off of the politics of respectability, where people challenged in a way consistent with people's trauma and righteous indignation, police violence and the entire system that allows police violence to happen, which is, you know, a violent nation and capitalism, where we see police, even during the protests, were more concerned about property rather than people. And people were more angry that protesters were standing up to do that. But at the same time, you know, there are people around the country who have been woken up because of it. So I think that's one of the most important things that happened from that. But as you said, there are still tremendous things and gains that need to happen.
Mm-hmm. Christine, you were right there in the ground zero in the St. Louis metropolitan area. I mean, some of your thoughts here on this third anniversary of Michael Brown's murder.
On this third anniversary, I'm grateful for the way that community came together, just like David said, just like you said. However, I'm truly disheartened in the St. Louis region alone. In the first year after Michael Brown was murdered by Darren Wilson, there was almost one a month of a black man or woman that was murdered in St. Louis area by a police department. We're still dealing with that today. Police officers on trial. His name is Jason Stokely, I believe, and he's on trial for killing an unarmed black man. It was intentional. He was found on tape speaking about killing this person, and we're actually sitting here in St. Louis worried to death that this man is going to walk free. A young white male, or at least he presents as white, was murdered on June 7th. His name is Isaiah Hammett, shortly followed by Isaiah Perkins. And these young men have been murdered in the city of St. Louis, and we're still fighting hard. And I know that we're not getting the national attention that we were getting, two, 3 years ago, but we're still here in St. Louis fighting every single day because the system hasn't stopped, so why should we?
Mm-hmm. No, I think it's a great point. Shout out to my guy Chuck Modi, by the way, as well, who I knew is out there, has been covering some of the activities that have been happening in the last couple of days around Isaiah and other folks. Sean Blackman, you're with the Stop Police Terror Project DC, that was originally known as DC Ferguson, connecting why Ferguson, I think, spoke so much to so many people around the country. Some of your initial thoughts here on this third anniversary of Michael Brown's death.
Well, the main thing that comes to mind is the response of the state to the movement, particularly since the rise of President Donald Trump, who was endorsed by police unions and who recently pretty much gave police a blank check in a recent speech, pretty much encouraged them to ratchet up brutality and commit these terror acts. We've seen legislation like stuff that, you know, the so-called like Blue Lives Matter bill, that would classify the death of a police officer as a hate crime, and other legislations that are clearly aimed directly at squashing dissent, you know, stuff that penalizes people for, say, like shutting down highways or blocking traffic and things like this. So we see these sorts of things, particularly from elements, and it's funny to me because I feel like these are some of the same folks that tend to poo-poo the movement and sort of act like it's not that big a deal, nothing to be worried about, but here it is, we're actually enacting laws to try to keep these sort of demonstrations from moving forward. And so, you know, from activist standpoint, from organizer standpoint, I'm just thinking about how the movement is going to deal with that moving forward.
And I think it's a good point. You know, Christine, I think what you said there is very true, that people in St. Louis have still been fighting and still been pushing on a number of different fronts. I mean, does it seem like people, I mean, you know, someone sets something on fire, every news agency on the planet Earth shows up at that place. And then as soon as, you know, the fire is doused, they're all gone. I mean, does it ever feel like the St. Louis area has been forgotten? Do you feel like people are doing the follow-up in the media or to some degree, is that also something that we're dealing with here on the third anniversary, is sometimes the shortness of memory and how we tell these stories?
Oh, definitely. I mean, the whole entire country has ADD, and it doesn't help that we have a president in charge who makes sure that we can't keep the focus. Mm. Especially at a local level where, you know, and to me, especially as being someone who's in office, local politics are so important. And I would say that, you know, yes, Ferguson is a hashtag nationally, but, you know, the actual, like, work that goes on here, this outside of us, you know, yelling at buildings or confronting, you know, the police, it has been washed away. It largely left when the fires were put out, you know, initially. And so, yeah, I mean, but I don't think that anyone who's here in St. Louis, who never gave up, who kept fighting, I don't think that we care. I think that we're here for the long haul and we're here for results and not just to have the world watching, because we want the world participating, not watching as we start the revolution.
I think it's a good point. I've said this before on the show that I think people sleep on St. Louis, but I mean, certainly we see with Bruce Franks getting elected, you were an elected official. We saw Tashar Jones make a good run at it. I see people setting up community programs of all types, feeding people, reading to people, the whole nine. I mean, it actually does seem like a really sort of dense network of grassroots community organizers is existing in St. Louis now. Is that a fair assumption to make, Christine?
It definitely is. And just because, you know, like myself, Bruce French, John Muhammad, Cori Bush, a lot of people, Tashar Jones, even though we've ran for office, we still have never given up our grassroots work because we know that the true fight is with the people. I work with the Eco Village, which is a group of women mainly who are rehabbing houses ourselves, grassroots, raising money grassroots in order to house women and children first. And initially we want to branch out and be able to help men. There's plenty of other cooperative organizations here in St. Louis doing similar work, and we are working together as much as we can. So definitely, especially with the politics, there's a great grassroots movement around politics, around getting people in the office, especially progressives, especially Black people, and especially Black women. And so I'm really proud of the work that we're doing here in St. Louis.
No, absolutely. Dave Ragland, you know, you've had the opportunity to travel a lot. I know you've even taught internationally. We got about 2 minutes here before the break, so I'll let you start this. We may have to interrupt you in the so way. But, you know, having been able to interact with people from around the world, what impact did Ferguson have internationally on people when they saw what was taking place there?
You know, a lot of people said that they didn't know that still happened. You know, a lot of, and I think that's connected to what Christine is talking about with ADD and America's short memory, but not just that, the way American media basically propagandizes the world about what happens in the U.S. And so just internationally and nationally, I think a lot of people had a very caricatured view of Ferguson. You know, seeing, you know, people with their shirts off and screaming in buildings, but they didn't see like the organizing that was going on behind and the national politics and even discussions and policy plans and proposals and all kinds of ideas that came out of Ferguson, but also that influenced. And, you know, we see like Ferguson style protest go on all around the country. And that's not to say that Ferguson was the originator, but it just happened to catch hold in a certain kind of way in Ferguson.
For sure. We're going to have to put a pin in it right there. We're going to come back with more with all of our guests here on By Any Means Necessary here on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social and economic movement shaping the world around us. And today we're continuing our conversation here with Christine Hendricks, who's a Ferguson frontline activist, a mother of three, and the secretary of the University City School Board, that's in the St. Louis area, Dr. David Raglan, peace and conflict resolution scholar and part of the Truth Telling Project in Ferguson, and Strong Black Men of the Stop Police Terror Project DC. And of course, we are speaking here on the third anniversary of the murder of Mike Brown. And Dr. Raglan, we left off on one piece there in terms of, you know, how people had seen this internationally, and you've had the opportunity to see people. And I want to kind of extend that point just a little bit to get your thoughts on this. I mean, you know, it does seem to me that from the point of view of pushing the ball, moving the ball forward on the issue of police violence in America, that one of the effective tactics is going to have to be going to the international arena and making this a bigger issue for the United States diplomatically. Your thoughts?
You know, so I think that's an important point, because and one of the things that comes to my mind is the story about how Mike Brown's mom spoke to the UN in Geneva. And, you know, one of the lawyers who's there, Justin Hansford, reported about how when all the lawyers and academics were talking, people were like, okay, this is a problem. But I think when Mike Brown's mom spoke to that panel, I think people began to see humanity. And I think what it takes is connections of empathy globally. People need to see the stories coming out of Ferguson. And from the truth-telling perspective, when we share those stories, I think people become more interested and connected, but also they see themselves in the Black protesters. And I think that, you know, it's U.S. interest probably not to have people globally connected to it. But at the same time, one of the things that we have to do in the U.S. Is we have to also carry the struggles that are happening globally so that we can share tactics and understand it. Particularly, we do know that's super helpful, because when protesters in Ferguson were on Twitter with Palestinians, you know, there was a connection, learning how to protect themselves from gas masks, just that simple, from organic protesters, people who had not protested before, connecting to people globally, and globally people seeing their struggle against empire mirrored in Ferguson, but also in Palestine, in Israel, where the Ethiopian Jewish people are struggling against the apartheid Israeli state, and so on and so forth. So I think there's those connections that are important. And this is what happened during the civil rights and Black Power movement, with folks like Bill Witherspoon and people like that who traveled and kept folks abreast of what was happening. But there are vibrant movements in Colombia, Brazil, all over the world where there are Black people struggling for Black lives.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. I mean, really, Sean, this is something that in some ways is really just sort of tried and true in the Black liberation movement, that taking it certainly to the international level. Of course, William Patterson's We Charge Genocide being the model there. I mean, your thoughts on the question I just posed to Dr. Raglan there, as someone who is an activist here in Washington, D.C.?
Yeah, when Dr. Raglan was talking, I was thinking about how a couple years ago I saw a interview with it was a Palestinian rapper, and he said that the second Intifada was our Ferguson. You know what I mean? And even if you want to talk about the Black Palestinian connection historically, I mean, you know, there's a history there. There was a Black Panther chapter in Palestine. You know, Huey Newton went over and met with some radical leaders over there as well. So yeah, I definitely think there's some truth to what he's saying. And you know, what I was thinking about is how, you know, Ferguson sort of as a symbol, I think it kind of forced some of us to sharpen our politics, if you will. Like, I know that's what happened with, with D.C. Ferguson, formerly now Stop Police Terror Project D.C. You know, it kind of came together in an ad hoc way. But at one point, the original organizers realized that, you know, we had to begin to find a way to address racist police terror and how it manifested, you know, here in the city that we live in. You know what I mean? And so that caused us sort of to take a step back and sort of reevaluate, you know, our tactics and orientation toward things, and I think made us a more effective unit.
Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, Christine, I think it was really just remarkable the way it played out. I think for those of us, especially watching around the country, just the organic connection between just grassroots everyday folks and Ferguson and people around the world, Palestine, but in other places, you know, raising their voices in support. I mean, I just thought that, you know, so much in this country, everything is, you know, it's about, you know, it's America centric. It's America first. It's American exceptionalism. And that was a great moment where I thought internationalism, people coming together over right or wrong, really shone through. As someone who is there in the thick of it, how did that feel to see people around the world, you know, rallying to the banner?
It was surreal. It's still surreal. It's St. Louis. I mean, if you're from St. Louis, then just saying that alone, you know what I mean. Mm. You know, St. Louis has been forgotten for a long time in terms of a lot of things. And it was amazing. I think right after Mike Brown, I went to the Dominican Republic on vacation. It was for my sister's 40th birthday. And we were speaking with Dominicans, and they had heard of Ferguson. If you live in St. Louis area, Ferguson is a dot on the map. It's, you don't even probably call it Ferguson. You probably call it North County or And for people in other countries to be able to say Ferguson, Missouri, and know exactly where that was and know exactly or have an idea of what happened, it was just truly just mind blowing. I don't think that it still has ever really caught up with me that, you know, somebody on my Twitter feed said, you all have people around the world that you don't even know who love you. And to me, it's mind blowing. Like, I had to stop and breathe and think that the work that we did here and that we continue to do is history, and that we have a place in world history, American history, and that we, in that event, really, as other people have said, it really kind of woke the world up to America not being exceptional, especially as it comes to our history on civil rights. And it exposed that no matter what we teach, that we still have not, you know, lived up to the promise that we make, and especially how we try to enforce our morals that we're not even forcing here at home around the world.
Mm. I think that's a fantastic point, for sure. And I think, Dr. Ragland, it speaks to some. It speaks to me, and certainly in my mind, in terms of even how we are. How we look and how we view ourselves in relationship to, you know, the quote-unquote U.S. government. It's certainly a question that I think Black people have thought about for some time and are continuing to think about here moving forward. But, you know, in the context also of a Trump era, Dr. Ragland, I'm curious, you know, what you think. I mean, I don't want to say that the Obama administration was super responsive to what, you know, was coming out of the streets. I think they did the bare minimum of what they could have done. But now when we're in a situation where obviously even the bare minimum will not be taking place, perhaps even, you know, maybe more aggressive things coming out of the federal landscape here. I mean, I wonder how you feel about the ability of the movement to advance. I think some people feel that it's been a little wrong-footed by Trump coming in, moving forward here. I'm curious some of your thoughts there.
So this is something really important at this point. And I think that what we're going to have to do as a movement is, in part, provide some of the direct services that our community is going to be missing under the Trump administration and whatever happens, Trump-Pence regime. But I think we have to figure out several things. You know, when the government won't provide basic needs, you know, similar to, you know, how the Black Panthers approached the movement. How do we provide for our community, provide support, be a place where, you know, our kids can go? What community places are important? I think so. That's number one. How do we transform movement infrastructure to support the community, and how do our allies help with that? And then I think number two, how do we protest in ways that are not traditionally? And I've said this, and this is probably one of the themes that I talk about on your show often, is that, you know, the study of war is, you know, since this society, since Western civilization began, is began with the study of war. How do we study nonviolent or different kinds of strategies and be more creative. So, for instance, if we can't protest, for instance, what kinds of things can we do that doesn't, you know, break the law or land people in jail for 20 years and at the same time resisting get a particular message out? And that's very possible. You know, it was done against Slobodan Milosevic. There are strategies around the world where people continue to resist. People resisted in concentration camps.
That's true. That's very
and so
true.
I think it now it is time to put our money where our mouth is and support communities in ways where we can be resilient and where we can resist and be creative. There's the online community. There's so many different things that we've seen people be creative around, and I won't go into them now, but people are getting a sense of what I'm talking about. Everything is possible if we are creative and we don't allow people to tell us that we can't do it.
Sean Blackman, resistance in the Trump era.
Yeah, well, the one word that comes to mind for me is structure. I think when things sort of began in earnest after Mike Brown's death, I feel like, you know, frustration and the desire to do something was enough to sort of keep people active and keep them involved and keep them coming around. But I think as time goes on and folks found that perhaps there, you know, wasn't quite as much to do if there wasn't necessarily a particular incident to sort of organize around, I think that that creates a danger for people to sort of taper off and perhaps become inactive. So, you know, I think, you know, within our organizations, we just have to be clear on, you know, what leadership is going to look like, what our politics look like, and what activism in our space is going to look like. And that's going to deal with the creativity piece that Dr. Ragland just spoke to.
Yeah, no, I think that's 100% true. Christine, I'm curious, your thoughts, resistance moving forward here under the type of president we have now.
Sometimes I get so frustrated with President Trump. It's so hard. But I mean, I just really think that, you know, like David said, it's really important to like really work on the systems that a lot of times the government provides that we should be able to do for ourselves. So again, I go back to housing. I go back to feeding people. That's something that we're doing here in St. Louis that what the Eco Village does personally is we have an urban garden. I have a garden at my house. We get donations from Whole Foods and we give out free food to the community because those are the things that are going to break down first. And in order, I think one of the things that Panthers did great and what I feel is a motto in my own life is that when you want to build community, you do that around food. If you can provide food to people, people are more likely and more willing to listen to anything else that you put behind that, right? And so like we first and foremost need to build those systems to meet people's basic needs. So when the system does break down, you know, people will be taken care of. And to me, that is the greatest act of resistance is to have your own. And so that's something that I think that we want to promote more and more and to continue to be Black and to be Black out loud, to be bold, to care about our culture, to love our culture, to enact a new culture here in America that's different from the mainstream culture that is about taking care of and providing for and supporting and loving our fellow human beings. And I think that is the greatest act of resistance again against Trump because he's so much about hate. And so we need to just put our arms around and love the people that are in our community, make sure that we're taken care of. And I think that we'll get even more grassroots resistance from that.
Sean, I want to swing back around to something that you had said before in terms of the issue of structure. I mean, this has been something that a lot of folks have talking about. It certainly was the topic of the article in BuzzFeed or whatever. About the movement for Black lives being, I don't know, adrift, dead, whatever. I forget the whole thing now. I mean, you know, some people are saying that there needs to be, you know, a organizational rethink. That part of the problem is that people who want to become involved now are 3 years in, that if you weren't a part of that original sort of activist group of people who, you know, came out and was in the streets and helped form these different organizations, that you're sort of in the outside looking in and it's difficult for people to connect. I'm curious what you think about that critique.
Well, I think number one, when you want to do this sort of thing, I mean, the first thing is, you know, to make folks understood that they are, in fact, welcome and, you know, have a sort of clear way for them to plug into what it is you're doing. And then once they plug in, you must then have something for them to do. You know what I mean? I think that's sort of a bare bones thing. Sometimes I, you know, I see things that happen and, you know, folks, you know, like they can have, you know, large meetings, you know, that can bring people in, but there tends to be a lack of sort of extended campaigns and things like that that'll give people a reason, you know, to come back and to stay involved. Because if they don't know, you know, what it is that they're supposed to do, then they don't have any reason to show up.
Well, let me ask you this follow-up too, though, because I think the question I'm asking you this follow-up as well as a younger person who's become an activist is, I think the response a lot of people give is well, you know, this isn't your grandfather's activist movement, whatever. And so we don't need to look to the same types of organization or whatever it may be. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I agree with that in the sense that, you know, if we look at typical civil rights organizations, there's, you know, usually, you know, an individual at the head of everything. And so, you know, when you do that, then you make it sort of easy, you know, to be destroyed. You know, you can, you know, that's why we see, you know, King get assassinated, Malcolm gets assassinated, Panthers assassinated and locked up, and, you know, all across swaths of different liberation movements. So in that sense, you know, I think that's true, but I don't think it's entirely healthy to, you know, abandon, you know what I'm saying, the lessons, you know, the history have taught us from some of these groups and some of these organizations.
Yeah, no, that's a good point there. Dave Ragland, I'm curious, you know, your thoughts here on a similar question. I mean, I think in some ways, I think there are some people who think there should be more of a NAACP style structure or something like that for the movement for Black Lives, where people can easily become members, engage or whatever. What do you think about the way the movement is structured and how people are organizing?
You know, I think that has happened organically. Like, the movement for Black Lives is like an organic hodgepodge of different organizations, including Truth Telling, that all have their own lane and focus on different things. And the thing is, right now, we're all in a pattern of political education. Like, we're right now, you probably know this, but the organizing is off the charts. Like, the coalition building across movements is going crazy. And I don't think that a particular style of an organization, you know, would be the answer. You know, the NAACP, you know, just got rid of their CEO and has a new interim CEO. And, like, you know, even like the notion of a chief executive officer for a movement organization, you know, I think that when we said the whole damn system was guilty as hell, we meant it. And like, you know, brother said earlier, we have to organize differently. We have to organize and provide political education so people are ideologically committed to a struggle where human freedom is actually possible, and that people are educated in ways so that they can build their own kind of resistance that doesn't rely on, you know, like the charismatic leadership that often, you know, those just mentioned earlier, can be disrupted easily. Mm-hmm. So the structure has to be diffused, and it has to be like, and we've learned this from other movements, you know, prior to the movement for Black Lives.
For sure. Well, I think we're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately. I apologize, Dr. Ragland. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back with more here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about the continued crisis, I guess you could say, or tensions, or however you want to term it, in Northeast Asia. And we are very happy to be joined here by Stephen Gowans, who's a writer and a political activist. Mr. Gowans, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
You know, the one thing that I really just want to start on here, because it just seems that There's no conversation can be had about the DPRK, about North Korea in the United States of America without flipping the script. Because the way it's presented here is, well, North Korea is just some totally out of control menace run by a madman that's getting ready at any moment to, like, launch a nuclear missile against us. And so even when people are, you know, whatever, criticizing Trump, they don't lose this frame, the basic framework that Trump is working from in all U.S. presidents, this idea that really the onus is on North Korea to stop being so belligerent as opposed to the United States to move forward diplomatically. So I was hoping, I don't know, it's not really a question, it's a statement, but your reflections on that.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It does flip everything on its head. The United States has been very provocative. Of course, the portrayal of North Korea is that it's the provocateur, but that isn't the case. It's responding to provocations. And it should be clear that the United States is engaged in provocations. In fact, some of the mainstream media has been pretty open about that. For example, the Wall Street Journal, not too many weeks ago, summed this up by saying the U.S. military has conducted several flyovers near the Korean Peninsula using B-1B nuclear bombers, directed a nuclear aircraft carrier group to the region, and they noted all to North Korea's consternation. In fact, the United States has been testing ICBMs while complaining that North Korea is testing ICBMs. Just yesterday, the United States sent again B-1B bombers over the Korean Peninsula. These are intended to intimidate, to threaten the North Koreans, and the North Koreans respond by saying, if you're going to threaten us, if you're going to you're going to intimidate us, then we have a means of defending ourselves now, and that means those the nuclear weapons we've developed. And we've developed those nuclear weapons not because we wanted to threaten you, but because you continue to threaten us.
And I'm sort of, what are the points of negotiation here? I mean, certainly I think that that's, myself and others and many people saying, well, there should be diplomacy, diplomacy, diplomacy. I mean, what do you think are the ways that the U.S. could de-escalate this situation? I mean, I think that the way it's presented, it's not, is that North Korea wants nothing, that it's just a country run by insane people. Obviously, that's not the case. What are some of the things you think they are looking for in terms of relationships with the United States and the rest of the world?
North Korea wants to be left alone. It wants to be left alone to develop by its own playbook, by its own rules, to achieve its own goals. But the United States is not prepared to leave North Korea alone, has never been prepared. From the very moment North Korea was founded as a state in 1948, the United States has been trying to topple the leadership and to absorb North Korea under the U.S. umbrella. The North Koreans would simply like to live their life free from that kind of intimidation, free from that kind of interference. But the United States is not prepared to allow, or hasn't been over the last seven decades, prepared to allow North Korea to pursue its own independent course of development.
You know, on the issue of sanctions that are here, I was watching CNN a little bit this morning, and I was one of their pundits or talking heads was on there who was talking, and the lady who was the anchor was like, well, you know, on sanctions, do you think that the sanctions will cripple the economy because their economy is so, you know, bad or whatever, and so on and so forth. And I got an elevator. I didn't hear the guy's response. But I thought that was an interesting thing because I also read in the Financial Times about a month back that the economy in North Korea had actually been improving. And so I wonder if the sanctions, as opposed to being an issue of destabilizing the regime, as sort of at CNN was trying to paint it, may in fact be something that's more around the issue of really trying to turn the screws on people whose lives maybe have been at least slightly improving. I'm curious what your thoughts are on that.
Well, I mean, the United States has been waging a seven decades long campaign of economic warfare against North Korea from 1948. And it has been aimed at crippling the country's economy and making life miserable for ordinary people. And, you know, all of this has conferred upon North Korea the unhappy distinction of being the most heavily sanctioned nation on earth. Topping this off is the UN Security Council Resolution 2371, which seeks to reduce by one-third North Korean export revenues. Despite all of that, North Korea seems to survive. The United States have been trying to make North Korea collapse for decades, has been expecting the collapse, but it hasn't managed to achieve its goals. I mean, and the United States keeps writing off North Korea, saying that the government's going to collapse any day soon. In fact, the Clinton administration predicated its policies on the coming collapse of North Korea. Obama did in many ways as well. But, you know, 25 years after the dissolution of the USSR, on which the North Koreans depended to a large extent, and after the USSR dissolved, many thought that North Korea was going to collapse. But, you know, 25 years later, the North Koreans are stronger than ever. Their economy is growing faster than it has since the collapse of the Soviet Union. And they've also been able to develop a means of defending themselves against the United States, and that is through their nuclear weapons program. It's a purely defensive program, which is something that ought to be emphasized. And anyone who's serious in Washington within the foreign policy establishment knows that. They know that North Koreans are coldly rational. They know that North Koreans recognize that this is not a offensive capability, that if they are to ever attack the United States, they would be completely annihilated. But they've developed these weapons as a way of saying, if the United States is going to attack us, well, we have a way of retaliating. Even David Sanger, the New York Times reporter, who's also a member of the prestigious Council on Foreign Relations, wrote an article not too long ago in which he said exactly that, that the North Koreans are not irrational. They would not launch an attack on the United States. They're not suicidal. But the problem for Washington is, by having these nuclear weapons in their possession, they're able to retaliate. And that's not something Washington is willing to tolerate, the idea that the North Koreans actually have a way of defending themselves.
You know, one of the other refrains we hear on just a regular basis here in the United States is that, well, China needs to control North Korea. Your thoughts, can China control North Korea?
North Korea is very serious in its pursuit of independence. And can they control North Korea? I don't think so. They can influence North Korea. I don't think that, again, going back to those people who are serious in Washington, the U.S. foreign policy establishment, no one in Washington who's serious actually believes that the North Koreans are going to relinquish their nuclear weapons capability. And they don't believe that the Chinese are going to induce them to do that either.
You know, how much do you think the history of the Korean War and certainly what the United States perpetrated there on the peninsula is influencing how the North Korean leadership is viewing things, or at least certainly what the United States might be capable of? I feel like that's something, the Korean War, they say they call it the forgotten war in the United States. I think most people couldn't even tell you more or less anything about it other than what its name is. And I'm curious, on the Korean peninsula, how do you think that history plays?
Yeah, forgotten war in the United States. I mean, if you look at the fatalities of U.S. troops, fatalities in the Korean War, they amount to only 1% of the total fatalities in the war. Most of the fatalities were North Koreans. This had a devastating effect on North Korea. It essentially destroyed the country. It has an enormous impact on the North Korean leadership and the North Korean government. And the United States knows that. And we know this because in 2013, the U.S. Military developed what they called their playbook. And the playbook was a plan for intimidating North Korea, which is something that's done every year with these massive war games that are carried out on the Korean Peninsula. Massive war games that the United States and South Korea carry out to intimidate the North Koreans. But in 2013, this playbook came to light. And the playbook said one of the things we're going to do, and the United States has been doing this since 1993, is fly nuclear-capable bombers over the peninsula. And they said, We're going to fly them over the peninsula, and we're going to do it during daylight hours. And we've deliberately chosen daylight hours so the North Koreans can see that we're flying these bombers, because, in the first 6 months of the Korean War, the United States essentially bombed North Korea into complete oblivion. Now, interestingly, one of the U.S. officials said, the reason we've done this is because we know. The reason we fly these B-2 bombers during the daytime so that they can see them, because we know how they're going to react. We know how they're going to react because they said we could fly at night, but the point was for them to see them. The defense officials acknowledged that North Korean military officers are particularly agitated by bomber flights because of memories of the destruction wrought from the air during the Korean War. So, yes, that's exploited by the United States, and that's something that North Koreans are very sensitive to.
Now, seeing Mr. Tillerson there, the Secretary of State, on his way out of the region say that there was no imminent threat from Korea, I mean, how are you viewing Trump's comments? I mean, just sort of as random bluster, not really connected to their real policy, or the potentiality maybe for a real escalation here? I mean, I guess there's already been some escalation, but, you know, potentially even greater is hidden in those comments.
Well, interestingly, although we might find the comments to be particularly frightening and attribute them to Trump uniquely, this is all part of the Obama nuclear doctrine, which we seem to forget. And that doctrine said that non-nuclear states that abide by the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty would not be threatened with nuclear retaliation by the United States. But Obama added, if they're not going to play by the rules, if you're going to be a proliferator, then all options are on the table in how we deal with you. In other words, we're not going to allow other countries like North Korea to develop nuclear weapons. And if they do, all options are on the table on how we are going to deal with you. When we have McMaster talking about the United States preparing plans to launch a preventive war, and others saying that there are plans for a preemptive military strike, this is all consistent with the Obama nuclear doctrine. Mm.
Well, I mean, I think that's an important point to make here is, I mean, it seems that, Clinton, Bush, Obama, now Trump, I mean, that there is a certain, I mean, certainly Clinton obviously was a little bit more willing to cut a deal and had made a deal with North Korea there at the end, but that more or less the default seems to be that a deal can only be made more or less at the expense of North Korea. I mean, they essentially have to bend the knee in some way, shape, or form for the United States to really be willing to entertain the idea of real diplomacy. Do you think that's a fair statement?
Yes. And, you know, something I should also emphasize, though, when there's talk about preventive war, I should point out that this isn't to prevent North Korea from launching a strike against the United States. It's to prevent North Korea from developing the means of self-defense. That's the idea. Intervene now. Right now, their means of self-defense is still under construction. It's still not even clear whether the North Koreans have the ability to deliver a nuclear warhead that can survive reentry. So there's a danger for the North Koreans at the moment that the United States will indeed intervene to prevent the North Korean side from developing or finally to consolidating its nuclear weapons program so that they do not develop that means of self-defense.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that perhaps, you know, to a lot of people seems obvious, but I think it's worth delving into a little bit here. I mean, if there was a war on the Korean Peninsula, it seems like it would be catastrophic.
It would be catastrophic for the Koreans, yes. Indeed, it would.
We'll have to see, how this develops in the Trump administration. I mean, certainly, hopefully, the statements by Tillerson mean that there's sort of something of a backing down here. I mean, I'm curious what you see in the new South Korean president, who I assume is not in favor of increased tensions here, has wanted to talk. I mean, could sort of resistance from South Korean people also play a role here, given that, you know, most – I would say the vast majority of people there definitely do not want to see another war.
No, they don't want to see another war. They don't want to be caught because they would be caught in the middle of it. They're pawns, and pawns often are don't survive the game. And I think they recognize that. So, no, this has terrible implications for South Koreans. Whether the South Korean president has much sway in Washington, well, I don't think it has that much, but...
We'll certainly have to see here. You know, I'm curious what you think about Shinzo Abe and the Japanese. I mean, they've been saying they want to attain more offensive weapons here as well. I mean, do you think they may strengthen the hand of those who want to take a more aggressive line here in Washington?
Well, I mean, the Japanese are using this as a pretext to remilitarize, and they want to do exactly the same that Washington's done. They're talking about developing the means to launch preventive strikes against North Korea, not to prevent the North Koreans from attacking Japan, because the North Koreans have no interest or intention of doing that, but to prevent the North Koreans from finally developing their nuclear weapons capability. But they've been trying to remilitarize, trying to find some kind of justification to do that. And the Japanese have been exploiting, this North Korean situation to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think it's certainly clear that that's something they've been pushing for some time now. I mean, obviously, the UN sanctions were able to pass unanimously there, but some might say that that sort of was a design to maybe prevent something more aggressive happening from the U.S. unilaterally there. Do you expect China and Russia to really offer any sort of real resistance here in the Security Council if America tries to escalate?
Yes, I would expect that. I mean, they did go along with the sanctions resolution, but there's always the question of you can go along with the sanctions resolution and you can approve it, but are you actually going to abide by it? And there's some question about whether the Russians or Chinese are actually going to follow the resolution. But yes, I certainly would think that the Chinese, or I would expect, although I could be wrong, but I would expect that the Chinese and Russians would use their veto to... oppose any kind of U.S. intervention, military intervention.
Well, I mean, it just seems that, that may end up being the key block here, but we'll certainly have to see how the United States is reacting to any of that or dealing with any of that. So I do appreciate you being willing to join the show here today and give us some of your thoughts. I know that you are writing and doing a lot on this as well as Syria and other issues. So Stephen Gowans, once again, I appreciate you joining the show. Hopefully everyone will check out your work. That is where we're going to have to leave it here today on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and we will see you next time.
By any means necessary.